This is the Meat Eater podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless because I'm wearing my swim trunks from the jungles of Bolivia. And we've been out in the jungle for how long?
Oh, 8 days.
8 days.
9 days.
And we're back now stranded in a Catholic mission out in the jungle because the plane couldn't fly. We're a couple hundred miles due north of Santa Cruz, Bolivia. On the flight out here, you just pass like 100 miles of uninterrupted jungle.
Yeah, probably.
A lot of like slash and burn ag, so much so that the sky is, you know, low visibility due to smoke, but then you eventually get out of that and just fly over jungle. And you land here. There's no road system here. There's an airstrip. And it's just a native community. The tribe here is called Chimane. It's Chimane territory. And we've been up. We went up a river with a bunch of Chimane guys hunting and fishing. We've been up there just getting some good stuff, some bad stuff happening to us. Now we're back here stranded. It's hot. No one's wearing their clothes except Doty, who's got his one of his... Dodie buys those t-shirts. I don't know if you've ever been to like gas stations in Montana or places where they sell those airbrush. Or it'd be like a full moon and like some wolf's heads or like a...
Well, this one's special. This is a winged Native American on top of a winged horse. And it used to say Idaho.
It's a Pegasus.
No, the horse isn't winged.
It's not?
No.
Oh, no, but...
No, it's a horse, the horse sort of racing an eagle.
Yeah,
it's cloudy, and there's a horse sort of racing an eagle with a winged plains warrior.
This used to say Idaho. I once accidentally buried this shirt on a beach on Lake Ponderay in Idaho for 3 months. I lost it one night swimming, and then came back 3 months later and found it buried in the sand. Wow.
Did you go digging for it?
No, I tripped, like, I found it.
Wow.
So we have a ton of ground to cover. We got to talk about getting bit by bullet ants. We got to talk about eating monkey meat. A giant catfish called the Maturo. We got to talk about eating unfathomable quantities of dried salted meat.
Rotten sometimes.
Sometimes rotten. Another stuff, but first I want to say who's here. Philbert Baraboo out of Bozeman, Montana is here. Friends call him Phil. And he's a, what do you like to go by, cinematographer?
Sure.
Philbert's a cinematographer. Is it Philip for real or just Phil?
Philip for real.
Philip is a cinematographer based out of Bozeman, Montana. This is the first time he ever came out with us. This whole reason we're here, like why we're here, is we were doing a Meat Eater episode. And then Giannis Butelis, who is no longer Long Tong Yanni, he's now Yanni Chimani, based on his ability to excel at jungle craft here in Chimani territory. Particularly, he started out very strong shooting native bows. These guys at Chimani make their bows.
Let's introduce everybody and then just get into it. What do you think?
Take your time. Well, I was just wrapping it up.
Oh, okay.
Jeez.
Well, so Giannis is here. And that concludes. And of course, Dan Doty's here. Meat Eater producer, director, man all things. And these bows. How do I even start with talking about the Chimane Indians? Amer Indians. It's like a term, like, you know, like in Canada, you'd say First Nations people, right? In Alaska, you say Native Alaskan. In the U.S., we say Indian, Native American. Sort of the proper term down here is Amerindian.
Is that actually proper, though?
I think so.
I've only ever heard you say that.
Amerindian?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't heard that very often.
What do you hear?
Indigenous.
Indigenous.
Indigenous?
Yeah.
But I think an Amerindian is an indigenous South American. I could be totally wrong.
Maybe. I don't know.
Indigenous South Americans, the name's Chimane. Now, my understanding is that they came up, like, there was another people here some time ago, some hundreds of years ago, and the Chimane came up these rivers and down, like, through warfare, I assume, colonize these river systems here. And whoever they pushed ahead of them, they pushed out. And there's legend that there's still like, there's probably this legend in a lot of places, but some of these guys talk about legend or warnings that up some of these rivers, the headwaters of some of these rivers in this area, there are still uncontacted peoples.
It's called the ancient ones.
That they call the ancient ones. Yeah. It would be that the Chimane pushed them out. The Chimane live by small garden plots. So they live in homes built entirely of native materials. So like a bamboo type framework, thatched roofs. They have garden plots where they grow plantain, pineapple,
yucca, fruit,
lemons, no limes,
papaya,
guava,
a plant called barbasco, which they use to poison fish. And they draw their protein largely from the river. They have some modern forms of fishing where they have access to nets. They have access to monofilament and hand lines, but they kill a lot of fish using bows and arrows, and they kill a lot of fish using something we'll talk about in a minute called this, like they poison fish with this stuff called barbasco. But anyways, like on the surface level, what we were doing was we were coming out here with these guys who are establishing a business, trying to establish a business, have established a business. Taking people up the target fish called Dorado. And like a Dorado is this big, I mean, it's in the same broader grouping as piranhas where it has these really pronounced teeth and a strong jaw up front. But it's a very robust fish that'll take a fly, right? They're aggressive, piscivorous fish and they'll bitch slap a fly. So it's kind of like the new, it's like sort of like the new frontier of fly fishing is to come down to the jungles in South America and try to catch a Dorado. Dorado means gold. You also hear them called golden dorado. These big golden fish. They almost kind of resemble salmon structurally, you know. Thick. I mean, these fish got shoulders on them. Very powerful fish. Chimane like to eat them, but these guys are trying to establish a catch and release thing where dudes like Westerners will come out to try to catch one. Frankly, going into it, I couldn't really. I mean, I've caught the things before in Argentina. I couldn't really. I wasn't that excited about the prospect of coming out and catching them, but what intrigued me was just the river travel, where you're going up into areas that these guys are pushing up into areas up this river here that we're on, where like the Chimane haven't even been. You know, they go way up to the headwaters of this river, so it's a really interesting journey. And also the other thing that intrigued me a lot was hanging out with the natives, because they bring all their stuff to hunt, to, you know, to hunt and fish, and so we did a lot of that. And the fishing, frankly, was sucky. Yannis was a fishing guide for a long time. What would you say about the fishing, Yanni?
It was the fishing conditions were terrible.
Conditions were terrible.
We saw, as far as like turbidity levels, I don't know exactly how they measure them, but I think it's they like lowered like a white plate on a rope, you know, down into the water, and then at what point you can, you know, still see the white plate. And I'd say the best that we saw.
That's a test?
Yeah, to test turbidity. And the best that we saw, I'd say if it was like an 8-inch white plate, was maybe a foot.
Yeah.
And that might be generous.
You know, they test tenderness on meat?
Nope.
There's a thing called the Warner-Bruntler shear force test. We'll save that for another podcast. It rained like holy hell.
So anyways, yeah, to bring it into everyone's terms, as a fishing guide, if I would have come and seen conditions like this, you would most likely just turn around and take folks back to their hotel or whatever. But here we
can offer them a discount in the future.
No, just cancel the trip and just, you know, just take it. Yeah, because no, you know that fishing is going to be very, very, especially fly fishing, you know, where the fish really need to be able to see a fly. But in our case, it took us 4 days, 5 days to just get to our location. So it's not like you can just turn around at that point.
With promises of water, not only clear, but like crystal clear and blue turquoise.
Vodka colored.
When this river is clean, it's we saw pictures and videos of it just like paradise.
Oh, yeah, I saw a picture. It feels amazing. And what the thing is down here, you're trying to coincide. When you come down to fish, you're trying to come the dry season because when it, you know, it's underneath all the vegetation, the jungle, and on the beach is just this red mud, kind of nasty mud.
Clay.
clay, right? So when it rains, the river just turns reddish brown.
Yeah.
Rust. It turns rust color, and you can't see shit, right? So
in the moment, we witnessed numerous landslides. That
big ones,
big ones,
big enough to kill people.
No, definitely
big enough to bury you.
Car sized rocks. That one was a car sized rock for sure.
And certainly enough mud in one, like one big sploosh that it would could, you know, muddy out a river of, you know, 500 CFS, no problem.
And you to do this trip proper, you want to come down during the dry season. And we thought, I was on the impression it was dry season. Then we got down here and it was kind of like, oh, this is sort of the tail end of the dry season. And it rained enough all the time to mud everything up, but we're getting out of ourselves. So, to get to this place, what you do, I went Seattle to Houston, Houston to Lima, Peru, Lima, Peru to Santa Cruz, Bolivia, overnighted in a hotel. Then we got on some Cessnas, like chartered Cessnas, what are those, like four, no,
six
seat Cessnas, and flew out to a very rough, you know, airstrip kind of hacked into the jungle a couple hundred miles away. So two and a half hour direct flight flying. And you land this little airstrip. From here, we got into a bunch of dugout canoes. These boats are sweet because most of the local guys, and they're building one just for personal use, like family use, they just use a tree. So their whole boat is just hewed from a tree, like a dugout. Very, very long boats.
Narrow.
Very narrow, very long boats. So it was like you had to have a lot of, you know, control and discipline to ride these boats without flipping them. We were in these bigger ones.
You think they're made that way? I got a question for you. You think they're made that way for efficiency, for traveling up and down a river?
So you can. I think it's most boat you can get out of a tree, man.
Yeah, I would say it's a practical thing.
So if the tree was bigger, they would have a like a greater ballast?
Maybe.
I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. These boats are, like, you see some on the water. I'm not exaggerating. Say they're 20 inches wide. You see 6-7 people. Big, long, I mean, like, imagine, like, a big, long, skinny tree hollowed out. But the ones we were in, we climbed into four boats that the base, like, the hole was one tree. But then they, from the same kind of tree, they cut planks and make the boat taller.
Well, you're thinking our boats are 20 inches wide?
No, some of the ones you see on the water are 20 inches wide.
Uh-huh.
No, our boats are wide enough to set up like a lawn chair in it.
Yeah.
And you put a ton of weight. So we were running how many guys in the boat?
8, 9, 10 even at times.
You know, that many dudes plus very small amount of gear. And they're pushed by these air-cooled engines that resemble a Go Devil or a Mud Buddy. But they're made in Thailand. It's like an air-cooled engine mounted on it's like a Honda motor. With a company in Thailand with the very unfortunate name of KKK, who builds the shaft and prop. And so it's like this Thailand company, KKK, puts this, what's got like a 6-foot shaft, a very, very small propeller on it, and they use it to run the rivers. The maneuverability of these boats is so piss poor that you gotta have a dude up front with a push pole, because you're not gonna steer this son of a bitch. So you got a guy in the back with this long, long boat, I mean, like, well over 20 feet long.
The boats?
Yeah.
And a 6-foot shaft on the back with a teeny little prop, and one or two dudes up front push pulling, and a guy in back to help push pull to run these rivers. And so we all pile into this stuff and travel up river. And along the way, you pass these communities. And these communities are all Chimane. And they might have, the biggest one was
Kuchisama. It's called Kuchisama.
Kuchisama. There's like 100 some people living in it.
Not right in the village, but in the larger Kuchisama area. I think it was like 15 families, 150 people or something like that.
Yeah, basically, like, if you go up river, so maybe if you go up river 10 miles as the crow flies, which is 25 river miles, you go up, you pass these small little villages, these native villages, and they get more sort of they seem to get a little more non-westernized, or like fewer western influences as you go up river. And the last one you come to is at most of them are at tributaries. The last one, there's this tributary called the Pechene, and there's a town there, Pechene, and it seems to kind of be like a family.
It is. It's one extended family in Pechene,
run by a man who likes to pull a cork. A very intoxicated man, as we found. And then once you pass Pechene, there's nothing. upriver. You go up and it just gets wilder and you get into the mountains. So you start out and you're in flat ground and you start climbing up in the mountains. The first day we went up, so we went up and camped. You're pushing upriver. Got up, traveled all day again, camped, realized that the Chimane dudes or someone, the blame fell on them, but I think it's more complicated. It's like definitely more complicated than that. Someone forgot something back in town.
The fishing poles.
Someone forgot some fishing rods. Not all of them, but some of the fishing rods back in town. When I say town, I mean the mission we started, we flew into.
And I forgot my little fan, too. That was the real reason.
Dodie forgot his fan. So we had to stop for a day and send some Chimane guys down. So, but there's how many? There's four of us, two, you know, like Western-educated Bolivians. One lives in the U.S. who run this organization. And then a grand total, we started out with
15
Chimanes and picked up two more Chimanes in another village. So a horde. We were like the old days. We were like back to the 19th century expedition. Mm-hmm. Like we're like when Roosevelt went to Africa to hunt and they had 100 and some porters carrying the stuff to hunt. It was like that.
It felt a lot oftentimes like a school field trip. Like when everybody got moving and going, I mean, walking down those trails, there were a lot of heads to count.
It felt to me like 19th century exploration.
That too.
Besides like a dude with the pith helmet and like it, someone like hand them lemonades all the time while all these native dudes carry everything around.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of weight. It was by far the biggest expedition that we've ever, I mean, we've done some larger expeditions, but not, I'm part of it's a question of efficiency too.
Yeah.
It wasn't especially efficient.
No.
Of an expedition.
The only time having that many dudes came in handy was packing up camp. Like, they could get camp packed up pretty quick. But other than that, there's, like, a lot of people with nothing to do. But they're all having a good time because they're getting paid, and they're getting to go somewhere cool, and it's better hunting and fishing than it is at home, or certainly has the potential to be a lot better hunting and fishing than it does at home. And then these guys might grow up and live their whole lives on the river, but have never gone up the river as far as we went.
I'm kind of glad there was that many, though, because just in the sense of meeting that many different guys, because that was it was handy to have them around when we were drinking at night and, like, just getting to know them.
I was made uncomfortable by it at first because it's like when you envision like impoverished people from other countries thinking about Americans, right? You're sort of almost coming down like living like probably their worst suspicions. Like dudes who stand around watching you carry their stuff around for them. And it just made me a little bit uncomfortable because like, you want to be self-sufficient and to have someone be like, yeah, you know, we're from America, world's most powerful country, richest country, carry my stuff. You know, this is awkward for me. But at the same time, how can you fault a dude for wanting to make some money, man? And in the end, all this resolved. In the end, all this is great. And we made some good friends, despite a humongous language barrier, because the Chimane, some of them speak a little bit of Spanish, but the Chimane speak Chimane. The guys we're with who semi-organized the expedition, they speak Spanish, and so you're getting, for us, English speakers, Dodie speaks Spanish a bit, we're getting everything sort of third story. So anyways, we start at the river, we spend the afternoon traveling, camp on the riverbank, okay, just tent camp on the riverbank, wake up, spend the whole day traveling upriver, tent camp on the riverbank, realize that something was forgotten. So these guys get scolded in a way that I felt was inappropriate. And some of them are sent back downriver to retrieve these rods. We then spend 24 hours waiting for them to run all night and all day to come back up to that point.
So there was a rainstorm that night. Thunderstorm.
Big storm. Gully
big
wash.
Storm, yeah. What was cool, though, about their run that was interesting is, like, the next day we're in camp or they showed up at some point and we're like, man, where did all these big sabalo come from? And as those boys were running all night long, they had these fish, the sabalo, which we should talk about, but just jumping in the boat.
Yeah, there's this herbivorous fish here called a sabalo, and it's sort of the base of the river. So it's like the fish that everybody eats is sabalo. All the big fish eat sabalo. And the natives eat a ton of sabalo, a ton of them. And they're everywhere, man. And it was funny because we were going up and Giannis was trying to think. He's like, I think I've seen these fish before where some dude goes out at night and shines a light and the fish all start jumping out of the water.
when these guys get back from going down to get the rods, we just spent the whole day dicking around camp. When they go back to get the rods, they come back and they got a mountain of sabalo. And I'm like, what the hell are they doing? How are they catching them all? And just apparently all these sabalo jumped in their boat while they're running down river at night. In a big sabalo, they go up to like, I don't know, 3 pounds, 4 pounds. Mm-hmm. There's a hell of a lot of sabalo as long as your hand. There's, you know, a lot. They're big. They come back up. Do we even bother traveling upriver that night?
We did. We had a very short run of about 2, maybe 3 hours.
Traveled upriver again, camped down the bank. At this point, we've been dicking with fishing, and no one's caught a thing yet. Okay.
Nothing. I think we had one bite. Remember that one bite I had, and the fish got off.
That's right. Yep. We threw a cast net, caught some sabalo with a cast net. Wake up the next day, travel all day again, and reach as high as you can get the boats on the river.
They call it ahesis.
Ahesis, which is like a pepper. It's a pepper.
Yeah.
The natives used to grow up there and grow pepper. And that's kind of the end of the line. You're not going to get a boat anywhere beyond that. Even though there's still a shitload of river up above, you're not going to get a boat past that point. But then we're how many days into this?
Four. I think it's the fourth day we got to main camp.
So 4 days to get there, we realized we only got 3 or 4 days to be there. And the river, even though it's like supposedly, oh yeah, higher you go, clear it gets, all that, just river looks like garbage.
Mud.
So we plan out, right, well, we can't fish. So the first thing we're going to do is go out in the jungle to hunt with the chamane. Now, in Bolivia, it's like technically, this is something I have to look into more. It's sort of illegal to hunt, but everybody hunts. There's just no, like, hunting is completely unregulated, okay? Because the indigenous people have still, I don't say like complete autonomy.
There, yeah, so the way it was explained to us is just that nobody, I don't know if it would be legal autonomy, but it would just be like they get to do what they do.
And there's no regulated hunting. So there's no seasons, there's no bag limits, right? It's like up to the people to decide what they do. These guys like to hunt at night. They primarily hunt at night with flashlights, with bows, and it seems to be that recently what the technologies have been rolling in is break open shotguns
and 22s.
Double deuces. They got 22s. Two of the older guys that were kind of like seem like pretty experienced, I want to say woodsmen, pretty experienced junglemen. This is dude Marco and this dude Alberto. When we picked this guy Alberto up in one of the upper villages, I bought a bow from him, and I'll talk about these bows real quick. They make bows entirely of native material. So the actual bow is one piece. It's not laminated. It's just like one carved piece. There's a plant. They make fibers from a plant. And they weave it for a string. The arrow is a reed with a four shaft. And the reed's soft. And they, what do you call that, like the string? Like serving. There's serving on each end of the shaft made from another plant that they weave into a string, a thread.
Cord.
And wrap it. They fletch it with different feathers.
Either curacao or we saw, what else did we see? Toucan?
Was it a toucan?
I think so.
I think it was a toucan.
Some feathers on the toucan.
The bow and the tip are made of bamboo. Some form of bamboo.
Yeah, there's a shaft. There's like a shoot on bamboo they make a tip from. And everybody carries the same collection of arrows. They'll carry a couple fish points, which are like these long, thin points with barbs carved into them.
And when you say long, they're probably close to 2 feet?
Well, the whole damn arrow's
18 inches, 2 feet.
The whole damn arrow's 4 feet tall.
Yeah, it's definitely the longest arrow you've ever seen. And the point is made long because you're going to be shooting fish in shallow, rocky water, constantly dulling it, and so that you can quickly resharpen and be back in the game. So I'm guessing one of those points lasts a lot of shots.
You get a lot of shots.
Right, 50 shots.
That's what I was most impressed by, those fish points and the hardwood and how easily they would pierce a fish, and how even maybe better than metal it is, just because you can sharpen it so fast. That was really impressive to me.
We had been out with these guys, you know, these other like indigenous hunters in Guyana, and they probably started with the same setup, I imagine. Their bowls are very similar, but they were running, they had hog wire, so like that heavy fencing, and they would pound fish points out of hog wire and put a barb in them with a file. But you realize that their system was a little bit reliant on man-made materials. And these guys, it's just not, like, all shit from the jungle. Same with the boats. So everybody's get up, like every dude that's got a bow walks around with his bow, and he's got four or five arrows, two or three fish points. Then he's got a blunt tip, which is like a four shaft that's thinner than the end of a pool cue, with a big wooden blunt that looks like something you use to, like when you're making a mojito, like that thing you use to mash the mint leaves up.
Molcajete.
And then a big game point, or land animal point, which is a big, it looks like a spear point, but when you look at it, it's actually bamboo. And it's sharp as shit. And you can shoot it and then shave off a little bit and sharpen it. And it's like a spear point. No metal whatsoever. And this dude, I was asking him how much penetration he gets on something like a tapir, and a tapir might be 300-400 pounds, thick skin. He said he'll get 4 or 5 inches of penetration with that point. If you don't hit it in the heart, you will not find it. So you can imagine the shotguns are pretty popular. When we picked this Chimane Alberto up, I bought a bow from him. He was packing another bow with two fish arrows, and he brought a 16-gauge Russian-made shotgun that looked like it was made eons ago. The butt plate said Bacall, like Lake Bacall. And all the shotguns said was made in Russia. I don't think it even said 16-gauge on it.
I didn't see it.
And he had a homemade strap made from some Quicksilver strap, like the Surf Company. So we get there, and we're like, when do you want to go hunting? And he wants to go hunting at 5 o'clock. So we mess around, get a late start, and me and Dane don't already start following this dude Alberto, this dude Marco. Marco's got a bow, and he's got his fish points, his spear point is our thing. And we start walking. We didn't get very far into the jungle.
Maybe 10 minutes at the most, I'd say. 15 minutes.
And there's these little orange things on the ground that look like dried apricot. Like dried apricot quarters laying on the ground. And Marco turns to me, and I couldn't tell if he's making a symbol to me. We can't talk to these guys at all, right? It's all just gestures. Well, Doherty could use a little Spanish.
Barely, though.
But we can figure some stuff out. He turns to me and makes a gesture, like I think he's making a gesture like aroma, like he's sort of running his hand up to his nose as though he's, like if you were trying to cook something and bring the smell of what you're cooking up to your nose. But I now think
wafting,
that's the word I'm looking for. I now think he meant the stuff I used to eat the fruit. And there was kind of a smear on a leaf, like a shit-like smear, and he touched that and smelled it. And then they start looking up in the tree, and there is a monkey, a red monkey.
Red howler monkey.
A red howler monkey, yeah. Up in the tree. And you felt like the monkey spooked a little bit, don't you?
It did, but slowly. I think right when we first saw it, it was basically just sitting right there, maybe 15 yards up in the tree. And it slowly, I don't know how spooked it was. Maybe it was spooked, but I didn't feel like it was booking. I felt like it was just sort of ambling away, maybe. I don't know.
I want to say, too, man, these dudes are in tune. These dudes have lived kind of in the same place their whole life. They're super in tune to what's going on. And when you're out in the jungle, I haven't spent much time in the jungle at all. It's bewildering how much sound there is. It's deafening. There's all these sounds going off, and they don't give a shit about most of the sounds. Then we hear one sound like this. And they real interested in that, even though it was like 100 yards away. They got like, whoa, what was that? They like that fruit. And then sure enough, they look on the tree, and here's this howling monkey. And this howling monkey starts kind of leaving the area. And the dude with the shotgun goes after it. I'll let Doty tell us what happens next.
Yeah, well,
it's too disturbing. Yeah. It's too disturbing for me to talk about.
I didn't actually find it that disturbing. So we saw the monkey, and my first thoughts obviously were,
you guys have to turn around, look at the lighting. Watch this.
Oh, look at that thing.
Look at that.
Describe that. Yanni, describe that picture.
We've been watching it for probably 3 hours, and it's been just constantly this evolving giant thunderhead off in the distance. We're in very flat country, so it's a very big sky, and off in the distance there's a giant thunderhead that takes up probably 30-40% of the skyline. And
what it looks like is if you had a veil, and behind it were shooting off flash bulbs.
That's incredible. That's probably why we're here. That's probably the storm that kept us here today, I would think.
But the lightning is almost constant. It's just moving through this giant thunderhead, illuminating different sections of it. And there's still pieces of sun illuminating one edge
of it.
Looks
like that cloud in the movie Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it does. Right? It looks a lot like
just
that.
Just this big, dark, solo cloud just constantly.
Thank you,
Dave. And then Dave Pop comes in and just... Yeah.
We're some hardcore jungle shit out here. So anyways, here's this monkey.
Yeah, so there's the
here's
monkey.
A monkey. Here's a Chimani with a shotgun.
And all I'm thinking about, first of all, is just getting one clean shot of that monkey in the tree, which I was able to get several. So it wasn't bucking. It was there. It was red. It was obviously a howler monkey.
I would say it was aware of us.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I agree.
And it thought it was probably best to take off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't making noise, though, and it wasn't moving especially fast, because I think probably within 30 seconds, it was 30 seconds, I'd say, from when we saw it until the shot happened. And
he had barely left the tree.
He moved one tree over and came down closer to us. So
now, a howler monkey, I think if you were standing up and a howler monkey stood up, he's not going to reach your waist.
Not even close. I don't think, like, just above knee height, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. To the top of his head, if he's standing next to you. Long tail.
And, yeah, so, well, I think they looked to Steve first to see if he'd shoot it. Steve did not want to shoot the monkey, but Steve quickly said, shoot it.
Yeah, I had a bow with me. I had a compound bow I brought down. I didn't even know if I was going to use the thing, but I feel like it helped sort of in a communication way, you know, like fellow hunters kind of stuff. But there's no way. I went down like I'm not going to, like I vowed a long time ago to not hurt monkeys. Like where I draw a line.
But Alberto, the Chimani hunter, has no problem hurting monkeys, and in fact, he loves to eat monkeys, and they all do. It's one of their favorite. Their favorite food, it seemed to me, was the spider monkey.
Spider monkey,
which they call Marimono. This one they call Maneche, which is that red howler. And I mean, it was just, you know, like I have now filmed probably, I don't know, 50 animals getting killed, and. It was simple. There was a monkey in the tree, and there was a shot, and it took probably 10 seconds. I feel like maybe it was clinging on or something. Or
yeah, but what happened?
What do you mean?
What happened? First fell out of the tree?
I didn't see that.
Oh, I saw
you that. Saw that?
Yeah, I saw it.
Well,
the monkey gets hit. It was just like hitting a squirrel up in the tree with a shotgun, where you know he's going to come down, but you're not quite sure when. Like he's still kind of hanging on, and out. Jesus, man. Bats, lightning bugs, lightning bolts. Out comes a baby monkey that's riding on the monkey. The baby monkey falls, hangs up in the brush.
You saw that first? You saw that come down?
I saw the baby monkey come right out of the monkey.
Oh, shit, I didn't see that.
It was packing around a little baby. There's a happy ending to this. But the baby monkey falls down out of the tree. Then the big monkey comes down out of the tree. And then it kind of howled like a howler monkey.
A little bit. It moaned a little bit.
And it was dead, yeah. So these guys are tickled pink about that, and they pick up the big monkey, pick up the baby monkey, come up, have a smoke, pack some coca leaves.
And then cut the bottom of the tail off, which I missed on camera, unfortunately. I didn't see it.
Yeah, so this dude, Alberto, they're smoking, and these guys are into their substances, man, from everything I saw. They like alcohol, they like cigarettes, and they chew coca leaves, and coca leaves are what? I developed quite a fondness for it too, just as a physical act more than anything, but coca's cocaine, like cocaine comes from a coca leaf, but it's like a chemical process, I gather, to make cocaine out of it. But it's illegal down here to have coca leaves, and the Chimani, and Doty says all over South America, like working class people, native people, just pack their gum full of coca leaves. It's as mild as
not coffee. Just gum though, cheek. Yeah, cheek. It's not gum like chewing tobacco in the States. It's like a giant, and they call it a bolo because it's a ball. They form. It
looks like a cue ball in your cheek.
Yeah, definitely.
It numbs your tooth. It numbs your cheek and numbs your tooth. But other than that, I couldn't really tell what it does.
You really didn't feel anything?
I couldn't. It's not more than having like an espresso.
No, definitely not. I'd say even a little smoother than that. But you're missing the other important part is that they activate the alkaloids in it by baking soda, so a very basic substance. Basic substance. You take baking soda, you dip your finger in it, and then you kind of rub it on the inside of the bolo.
Yeah.
And that tastes good.
Oh, it
surprising.
Does. I was scared of that shit at first, but toward the end, I was packing some. These guys were running a racquetball. I was running a golf ball with baking soda. And they also drink alcohol to activate it. So we're out with these dudes, Alberto and Marco, interrupt this monkey thing for a minute. I think they got one water bottle. I'm just pouring sweat. Doty's sweating so bad he thought something was wrong with
him. I did. I thought I was fucked up.
Doty thought he was dying. So I said, no, I'm sweating too like that. And meanwhile, I'm just drinking water. I drink all my water within an hour. And these guys got one little 16-ounce bottle that looked like it had been, like, washed up on the beach, you know. And it's full of what I think is water. And every time they stop, they swap a swig. And all I'm thinking, man, these guys don't drink any water at all. They're just, like, barely going through this one bottle, and I realize it's this stuff that's like taste. What is it?
It's called Singani. It's a great. We're drinking it right now. It's liquor made out of grapes. It's kind of like a
very strong
grappa in Italy, but it's made.
But they like it too because it releases more of the alkaloids from the coca leaves. So, anyways, they shoot the monkey, have a smoke, have some more coca leaves, have some alcohol. Then Marco walks over to a tree and cuts a thong, like cuts a string of tree bark, ties it around the monkey's chest right below his arms. And this monkey, you're used to animals to have 6 or 8 teats. This monkey is nursing. And this monkey has 2 tits right where humans' tits are. And they look like humans' tits. And it has a human's vagina. Wraps the string around its armpits, wraps the string around its waist, and runs like across his shoulders. Takes a little extra string to tie the baby on there, and we head off into the jungle.
I think it's worth mentioning that...
Oh, the tail thing.
Well, the tail thing, and just, like, there was a moment, more than a moment, of sort of shock and sort of, you know, not that...
I was shocked by it.
That's what I mean. Yeah. You were shocked by it.
No, I was shocked by it. I don't mean to sound casual about it. I had gone, and the question... I had been out to dinner with some friends a couple nights before leaving, and we were talking about the trip, and I was saying, I understand these boys love spider monkeys. And I said, I will not shoot a monkey. Like, I don't want to shoot. I would rather shoot a person than a monkey. Because I just, like, they're just, like, in the words of Jerry Clower, they're too much like folks. And to see that monkey get shot, not only that, but the way it was carrying around its baby, and also that it had breasts, human breasts, and a human vagina, and a semi-human face, disturbed me. I later ate the monkey, some of it, but it disturbed me no end, and I was a little rattled by it. But then it's like, I'm not going to tell these guys what it's your favorite food.
Yeah. So to elaborate on that, not only it's their favorite, like it is a delicacy. They like it better than deer. They like it better than paca. It is.
They like it better than beef.
They like it better than beef.
Dude, I asked them 100 times to have it translated. What's the best food? What's your favorite food? Is the monkeys?
Yeah.
Spider monkey, howler monkey.
Because it has more taste. That's what was translated back to us. Is because it tasted like flavor or sabor. Like there was something to it.
And the cool thing is this guy, Alberto, like he pulls out. These guys all carry little kitchen knives. Like if you were gonna have a kid draw like the classic kitchen knife, that's what they all carry. A lot of carbon steel. They'll have it from a paring knife side or whatever. No sheaths. They just like put the knife in their bag. Pulls out this little paring knife and cuts an inch of the monkey's tail off and buries it. And I thought it was an offering, which isn't outlandish to think because they later explained to us we would have had a better trip had we given more offerings of alcohol, cigarettes, and coca leaves to the river. We would have had a better trip. So he buries the monkey's tail. Later we find out you bury the monkey's tail, you cut the monkey's tail off so that the next monkey you kill doesn't get hung up by his tail in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good. Which makes me think American squirrel hunters should cut the front feet off. And Giannis came up with this idea. Tell him what you're going to do the next time you kill an elk. You remember saying this?
Put the grass in their mouth?
No.
He was going to splatter the blood all over the place. So the next elk had to get a blood trail.
To leave a better blood trail, man.
And then we take off into the jungle, and I don't think anything more happened at night.
No, not like of note, but I think after that I probably had my favorite moment in Meat Eater filming history, which was sitting in the pitch dark with those two guys on the top of the hill in the jungle, just like wondering what the fuck is going on, you know? That was my favorite.
You mean just listening to them talk?
No, well, that, yes.
Sitting in the dark.
That and sitting in the dark, hearing the noises of the jungle and hearing the noises of the hunters and just, like, just really soaking in that moment. Because that's not something you get to do. You know, no matter what. I've been in the jungle a bunch of times, but being with those guys in an actual, very authentic, you know, looking for game moment was pretty fantastic. I really enjoyed it. It's scary, too. You know, it's just an edge of, like, you don't know what you're sitting on. You don't know what's going on. You got all these thoughts of spiders and snakes and all this shit, but you're just sitting right on the ground in the jungle, like.
It is, man. It's a little bit, yeah, it's a little bit scary, but also beautiful. And it's like, because you can't tell what the shaman are saying, you know, they could be, like, telling a story, like, well, anyway, so I went back to Verizon, and they told me that the phone had gotten wet. I mean, maybe they're talking about something like that, but, like, it feels like they're talking about something different, and the language is, like, who here, and this comes from a place of love, who here would like to mimic the sound of the shamani talking?
I think Phil does that well.
It's kind of like...
Yeah, but not goofing on it. I mean, it really
super
is like
quiet,
born of
really
the jungle.
Quiet.
Like I later said, it's like the words fall to the jungle floor.
Yeah,
you know. You know, when you're out in the woods and you hear some dudes talking and laughing and shit, you would not ever in a million years be out in the woods and hear some Chimani dudes way off.
Mm-hmm.
Very
never.
Quiet.
Mm-hmm. Never.
They don't like talk loud by the river when they're fishing.
It's very guttural. There's like...
It's awesome. Like I said, they could be talking about the most banal stuff, but it feels like they're talking about some ancestral hunting business.
I got the sense that they were just saying super simple things, too. I mean, that I have no idea if that's true or not. But
they'll
like,
stop and gesture about trees and stuff a lot.
Yeah.
You know? And not carrying on a conversation, but just like, you know, sharing information. And then they would use their flashlights now and then, but now I'm going to stop and just listen. And, yeah, and the jungle's deafening, man.
It's worth to mention again, the volume of the jungle at night is just, it's mind-boggling. I was very on edge the night that I spent, you know, filming you guys hunting. It was, like, you're on the trail, it's daylight, it's like, all right, it's woods. You're just in the familiar woods. It doesn't matter if it's Montana or Bolivia, you're in the woods. These are woods. And then it got dark, and every time I step 6 inches off that trail, man, it's just like my adrenaline just pumped up just a little bit. Just, you don't know.
Do you think there's any place in the United States that has as loud of a night woods, like down south or anything?
Yeah, it's got to be around Florida or something in the swamps.
And, I don't know. Possibly. It's loud.
But it can't be like this.
I've been, yeah, I don't mean to sound like a blowhard, but I mean, I've been to a ton of places and I never thought this place is loud. Mm-hmm. The next night.
You're starting to hear it right now.
Yeah. The next night we go out, nothing of note really happened during the day.
Nothing happened that day. No fish were caught.
The next night we go out, and one thing I'll say, when you're walking down the trail, they're always kind of looking out for your best interest, and there's so many things out there that are going to mess you up. There's some snake. Did you ever catch what that snake was?
No, I don't know what it's called. I thought that it might have been the Bushmaster, but I don't believe so. It's a little green, skinny green snake is the worst kind.
Most dangerous thing out there. There's some spiders that'll mess you up good, and there's this little critter called a bullet ant. It's like, kind of, what, an inch and a half long?
2 inches.
So we get to talking about how we're going to go out and sit a salt lick at night with flashlights. And we leave before dark again and start walking through the jungle. And nothing really happened. No, what am I saying?
No, that bird.
We got after a bird. I missed the bird a couple times with my bow.
Each one of you missed.
Marco missed with his bow. Alberto shot up with a shotgun and missed it. But it's this small bird, a guan. They really want it. They call a lot of birds pava, which is Spanish for turkey. They're sort of like they know the names of them absolutely, but they refer to them generally the same way you might say game bird, I guess.
They refer to grouse, you think?
Yeah, maybe like, yeah, you use like the word grouse, right? And there's obviously a bunch of species of grouse. They use pava, and it's like bird that is good to eat. And of these pava, there could be any number of birds. Black and crestless curacao.
And the guans. I don't know anymore.
I don't know anymore, but there's a couple of guans. We get after one of those. Beautiful bird. They wanted it real bad. That turns up nothing. And through chasing this bird, we kind of wind up. I couldn't tell. Do you think we ever got this? This night, the first night we went out was me and Doty. Then the next night we go out, it's me and Phil Baraboo. Do you feel like we got to the salt lick? You have no idea what's going on because you can't communicate with the dudes you're with.
It seemed like we were because he broke branches. We got to this little creek bed, like small creek bed. And he broke branches like a shooting lane.
Yeah, that's what I felt. I felt like he was setting up for the night.
And then they both came up. We found a log, and we sat on the log like you would wait for any other kind of hunt.
That's what I felt like. I felt like, oh, he's clearing a little shooting lane. And we kind of get away, and we got flashlights, but it's still daylight out. Just getting dark. And the night before, I noticed every time we stepped over a log, they would examine the log and then take the bow tip and kill these big-ass ants on the log. And I got the sense, I mean, everything moves there. Everything's alive. You never run out of new kinds of bugs. I got the sense that they don't like that kind of ant. And we're sitting there, and I think it was just because I just turned my light on, maybe. I can't remember. Also, I realized there's six of these big-ass ants around us. And was it you got it first?
Yeah. Yeah, I got it. It was on my shirt. Well, I was worried because we were sitting there, and I was worried they climbed up under my shirt. And so just as I went to look, it stung me right on the basically first knuckle, my first finger. And I probably screamed a little bit.
Dude, it
and it stung like a bitch. And it basically, it was like a, it was a bad bee sting. But I didn't know what to think.
You mean initially?
Initially.
Initially it's like a bad bee sting.
Initially, and
bee sting times what?
No.
Times two, 1.5. Times five?
Yeah, it wasn't like crazy. Not like a honeybee, but like a hornet. You know, like a bad bee sting where you're like, that stings.
Yeah, you would have thought it was a hornet for 5 minutes.
Beyond, yeah. Like, you can't just say it smarts. It's worse than it smarts.
Oh, no, it's like, it's you don't think about something else.
Right.
You would be like, ah! You're like, what? Yeah. You saw me get stung on the bee, on the neck by a bee last night. Mm-hmm. I would have reacted about the same way in the first 5 minutes of a bullet ant.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but those bees were like a tenth of, wouldn't you say?
No, I'm saying the initial zap.
Yeah.
The initial zap was bee-like. It quickly becomes nothing like a bee, but it's the initial zap is bee-like.
But before you go into yours, so as a cameraman, I got stung. I knew Patrick, who is one of the guides here, had kind of mentioned everything that bites and stings, and you know. And I remember him saying bullet ant, and I didn't know if it was bad or if it was just like a bee sting or whatever. And so they're asking me, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it hurts, but I gotta keep shooting. We're here for
a certain amount of days." But they're asking if it's okay, but we can't. They're gesturing, "Are you okay?"
Yeah, and I'm just like, "Whatever. I'm gonna roll with it because we're out here hunting. We got to do this." So, and then all of a sudden, you yell out a yell.
Well, he at this point had said, "Let's go." So there was enough bullet ants here where we abandoned the plan to hunt the lick.
So they were aware of the bullet ants at this point.
Oh, yeah.
They already knew.
Isn't it funny that we got stung and they didn't? No, they were aware of the bullet ants when I turned my light on. I happened to turn the light on and was like, "Wow."
After you both got
there. Yeah, Phil gets zapped. They're like, "Let's go." We start walking and I get zapped on the ankle through a neoprene sock.
Jeez.
And then I have a very low tolerance for pain. And we make it out to the trail. And I don't know what's going on. I was like, I got hit by a lionfish one time and I hadn't read up on it. So it's like, you get hit and you're like, well, I know that it hurts and I can handle all that, but I don't know what this means for me. Right? Is it like getting bit by a rattlesnake? Like, do you go to the doctor now? Is the trip over now? And the guy, Marco, gestures to Phil. Explain the gesture.
He looks at me. So Steve got stung in the ankle. I got stung in the knuckle. So he first looks at me, points to where I got stung on his hand, and gestures up his hand, up his arm to his heart, saying basically, "This poison is going to go to your heart."
Then like he runs like a line, like excruciatingly slowly, this line up your arm to your heart. And we're like, I don't really follow what exactly that means.
And then they go to Steve and do the same exact thing from his ankle, but it basically ends at
your groin.
His ball sack. It's like,
yes, yeah, so he's like points a film, does it, then it'll go to his heart, and like, to me, the ball sack. And I'm like, so does that mean we die now?
Like, I don't know. We got these two guys both looking at us with concern. Like, they're concerned for us.
Very concerned. They start looking around in the trees and come back with a 4-inch chunk of vine. And the vine, when you cut it open, resembles almost like ginger root.
Exactly.
And he takes his knife and starts scraping and pulping the contents of the vine and packing it on our bites. And then he kind of says, like, vamo, like, you know, time to go, like, let's go, time to go. And points that we could either go back to our camp or go deeper into the jungle. And at that point, I realized that we weren't going to die because he was like, pick whichever one you want. We still had no idea what this meant or what. And now it's like intense arthritic joint pain. Wouldn't you say?
Burning and throbbing.
I got to say something here, because like you also called back on the radios. We had a radio.
This was
on.
A while later.
That was an hour later.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, way okay. later.
All right. Well,
and I don't even know why we didn't think about it until yeah. you
I didn't realize we had the radio still way later.
But that was the moment that I realized you were from the Midwest, Phil, because because you kind of got like the radio call, and you go like, you copy. I go, yep. You go like, oh, hey, just checking in, how you guys doing?
Like, oh, we're good. What's going on?
No, we were an hour into it, and at that point, it was way beyond, like, it wasn't intensifying. At that point, it was just like, you know what we called? I was thinking, there's no way I can sleep with this level of pain.
Mm-hmm.
That was where I was at that point. And Marco and Alberto had lost all interest in our bites. We somehow wound up way ass back in the jungle on the edge of the river laying there.
On these huge boulders. These huge boulders on this river. We shine for some fish, and then we're all laying out on these rocks.
Yeah,
we actually, get... before that, you got to mention the Benadryl.
Oh, so we took ibuprofen and Benadryl, which knocked our dicks in the dirt, man. Like, couldn't even stay awake. We're out in the jungle, middle of the night. Couldn't stay awake. Go down the river, and the minute we arrive at the edge of the river, Alberto shines light in the river, and I'm not shitting you, there's a fish's tail at the surface. You can't see 3 inches into the water, but there's a fish's tail. So Marco, real quick, loads his bow, the fish arrow pulls back, the fish tail vanishes, and then they decide that we will now lay on the riverbank on the rocks in the dark for an hour. At which point, and smoke cigarettes and eat coca leaves, at which point, I'm like, there's no way I can sleep with this level of pain. And I'm really sleepy from taking the Benadryl. And I remember that we had a CB and or a radio. And I'm like, there's no way they'll hear us. Like, there's no way we can communicate.
We're a long ways away.
Yeah.
But, well, not long ways.
But the canyon must
3 miles.
The canyon must be straight there because yeah. loud and clear. It's conveyed to us that it just hurts like a bitch and then goes away. And shortly after, it went away, the pain. Hmm. When we got back that night at 11:55, we got stung right at dusk. At 11:55, I couldn't remember which foot got hit. Like, gone. The bullet in.
You still have your bite, though, Phil, right?
Yeah, you can see a little bit, but it's not bad.
And it was never explained to us what he meant with the ominous... the ominous hand gesture up the arm and leg.
Which almost made me puke when he did
that. Yeah, then Phil got nauseous, and he couldn't tell if he was nauseous from the news or nauseous from dying.
Must have been the news, because he's here with us now.
I can't quite tell now if I'm jealous. I think I am. I can't tell. I am jealous.
I'm glad it happened.
Oh, I'm super glad it happened.
I'm jealous of you guys. I was on a river in Peru once, and the tribe that was there, their rite of passage for their kids. Like when a boy is 15 or 16, they like build a pillowcase and they put like 7 or 8 bullet ants in it, and then they tie that pillowcase around his forearm for like an hour. Oh yeah, and he gets bit, like hit multiple times for an hour. And that's their rite of passage into manhood. One of the rites of passage.
That'll do it.
Wow.
Yeah. Doty's got more jungle experience than more sort of like indigenous, you know.
A little bit, not a ton. I've spent some time in Ecuador and Peru doing some stuff, but...
I recall the number of days I spent in the jungle on my hands and toes. I mean, legit jungle.
Yeah.
You know, like real legit jungle. It's scary. The third night we went out... I'm skipping all the fishing parts, but the third night we go out, we started out at the other end. We started out way ass out in the jungle, so we'd gone off to fish all day. And we got a couple... big ass catfish, Maturo or Toro. Caught a Dorado. And it's just getting dark when it's time to go back. And Giannis And I, we, the whole day and crew there, like all 80 of us are out there, but we decided to like get a, to be the first guys down the trail. Everybody else will follow later. And we started down the trail, and right off the bat, again, bam, monkeys. They couldn't have cared less about these monkeys.
Yeah, they were a different species. I don't even know if we clarified what they were.
Was it capuchin? Yeah. Capuchin and capuchin, yeah.
We didn't learn from them what it was. But they're like, oh, there's a monkey, by the way. And I'm thinking, well, you boys sure, oh, we got to back up. The before the bullet ant thing, the night we get back with the mama monkey and the baby monkey, we're like way down the monkey. We want to film cooking the monkey. They go down the river. We're like, you can go ahead and gut it. So go down the river. They go down the river and they gut the monkey and pull out the kidneys, heart, and liver, and intestines, and flush the intestines. Turn them inside out. Put them all on a stick. And they asked if they can eat the baby monkey. And this baby monkey isn't as long. I'm looking right now at a water bottle. If you stretch this monkey out, he's not as long as a water bottle.
It's like a little kitten.
Like a kitten. They take the monkey, the baby monkey, burn his hair off real quick, cut him into,
quarters, man.
They basically head him and quarter him and fry him in a wok. Little arms, little head. It's a feat. They fried him up in a wok.
It was disturbing.
Yeah, no, he got walking out on his plate.
You don't need to sugarcoat it. For Westerners, for Westerners, it is a very, very shocking picture. Yeah. You know, we are just not accustomed to anything like that. It's shocking. It's disturbing. But to them, they were so excited, so stoked. And
They fried the baby in oil. The next day, cooking the whole monkey. They take the monkey, hold it by the tail, and wave it over the fire and burn all of the hair off the monkey. Then they scrape it with a machete. Then they go down the river and clean the monkey. Then he kind of cuts all the joints, just enough where he can break the joints. So opened up what would be like your ball joints at the top of your femur. Cut the knee joints a little bit. Cut the elbow joints a little bit. Took some vines. Did he use bark or vine?
For which part?
To bind the monkey. Trust it. He trusts the monkey with either bark or vine.
Yeah.
I think he might have used bark.
Yeah.
Cut more of those ropes from the bark. Yeah. And trust the monkey. And then they build a rack up over the fire. You notice they always stack their logs perpendicular. Like their fire, they like lay the logs. No, I'm sorry, not them. They always stack the wood parallel. They just lay a bunch of big logs parallel on the fire. Mm. They got a rack over it. Trust the monkey and then say he's going to smoke that monkey 8 hours, 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Smoke the monkey for 6 hours. Then just chopped it up in little pieces and they made monkey soup thickened. So water, monkey, and plantain.
And yeah, salt. But the plantain they like scraped with a spoon. It green was very plantain. Cool to see. Green plantain scraped real fine. And then so it became more like a meal. Because they became kind of a thickening agent or a gravy almost.
It would have been almost like monkey and cornmeal, corn mush, grits, right? But made out of plantain, skin on it. And it tasted like, I struggled, I couldn't think of what it tastes like. Now if I had to say it tastes like something, it tastes like a smoked turkey drumstick. Mm. With a very thick skin. These boys eat everything, they couldn't get through the skin. I didn't see anybody try to eat the skin. You can make a football out of that monkey skin. Mm. There's no meat anywhere. I mean, there's meat, but it's thin pieces of meat.
Whatever piece I got had, like, I got a good, like, mouthful of flesh when I took a bite. I don't know what it was.
I'm telling you what, it was good, though, man.
It was good.
Very mild. Very mild.
Dodie was alarmed because they threw the brain and the spinal column in there, and you always hear about diseases that may jump from monkeys, but I think most of that happens in Africa.
That's just a general thing. I think you're warned to not eat much spinal column fluid or brain. So that I still am a little alarmed. But
I was alarmed by the monkey. But I'll tell you what, the monkey was legitimately good, and it didn't taste like. And you can see why people like it. It doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah,
I mean it tastes good, but it's not. You don't eat it and think it's like. I know these guys are laughing at me. I'm like, now if I've never served monkey in secret, I'd be like, that's monkey. I feel like I got a, that I know now, like what monkey tastes like. They like the brain out of there, they eat the head.
There was, there's a, for me, a lesson there just in general about being a meat hunter, you know, and somehow, you know, the perspective of seeing these guys doing what they normally do and just comparing it to us killing a deer in Minnesota or in Montana, it was an eye-opening experience just to eat it and know that it was not any different than anything that we ever do ourselves.
You know? No, there was no like, ew. Well, all 17 guys lined up to get monkey. And they were lining up like if you had a bunch of dudes you hang out with over your house and you made chili. And you're like, chili's ready. And everybody came to get some chili. It was just like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh man, we're eating weird shit now. It was like, awesome, man. He made chili. His chili's so good.
You know? The difference being is we had to be strict about them not eating it before we were, like, they wanted to eat it that first night.
And they almost did.
Yeah, they almost did. We had to basically protect this monkey so we could film it.
Yeah, doing the chili thing, I don't mean like it was blasé. I mean like, you're hungry, your buddy made like great chili. I mean like excited, but not like, ooh, you know.
Yeah, I almost feel like it was more like if you were serving up tenderloin. There was that kind of excitement.
Yeah, you're probably. I was just saying chili marks is something you ladle out.
Yeah.
Marco ate his. He uses a banana leaf, a plantain leaf, to make a spoon, man.
I feel like we need to give that guy more credit. We need to, like, build him up a little bit. Marco was, like...
Yeah, you'll hear in his hunting story, though, the deer.
Oh, yeah.
Throwing that thing. Anyway, I can't spoil it. But.
Yeah, so third night out. Yeah, Marco's, like... Marco kind of emerged as... He looks older, but he's my age. 1 year older than me. He's 41. And,
but he looks like a solid 51, 55, yeah, maybe even.
Very hard hunter.
Weathered, you know, dark skin.
Traditional haircut. Later told us that... Later recounted this story to us about a jaguar he killed. Only when prodded did he bring this up, but a jaguar he killed that he has some hunting dogs, and he was out hunting one night, and a jaguar killed his dog, and he killed the jaguar. And it was a pretty fascinating story. If you go to themeateater.com, we'll be posting that interview. And we might even put the interview on the show somehow.
Yeah, I think we should. I think we will. Yeah.
So you see this other monkey in the tree, and they could give a shit about this monkey. And I kind of like, I'm like, they're looking at me. And I'm like, well, shoot the monkey. So I make the universal, like, pow, pow noise. And he kind of didn't care. One of them, Marco grabs a shotgun and goes off in that direction. And you said he had a shot.
Oh, yeah, I followed him. We could see the monkey jumping up through the tree branches. You could see, like, the full silhouette. Again, you know, nighttime. You could, but again, the sky still had just enough light where you could see the full silhouette of the monkey. He points at it, kind of gets his light, like, you know, positioned with the gun, pointed at it, and then just was like, let's go.
Yeah, they didn't want that kind of monkey. We go down the trail a little bit, and Marco's walking point with the shotgun. Alberto's behind him with the bow. I'm behind Alberto with a bow. And Giannis is behind me with a camera, and all of a sudden you'll see him, they get tuned in, and he knows something's going on, and all of a sudden Marco's got his light, his flashlight, and his shotgun. Alberto stops, and Marco kind of goes ahead, and you can tell that he's going to shoot. And bam, you know, with the 16 gauge.
And again, it's amazing because there's no way that I knew that we had any idea that
there was a critter. Saw shit. He shoots, and it's like he hit Godzilla. The noise. I thought it was a tape here.
Something big. I mean, it sounded like a horse could have been running through the jungle at that moment.
Loud. I'm like, holy, I didn't know what was going to happen. But what happened was he hit a red brocket deer, but he's too far out front and just hit the tip of his nose with buckshot. So his nose is kind of perforated with 4 or 5 buckshot wounds. Not fatal at all. And the deer, for whatever reason, runs up onto the trail kind of like in the middle of us all. And stops. I pull out an arrow and I can't see a thing. I pull out an arrow and try to sight it down the side and hit the brocket deer through the back leg. The brocket deer runs off in the jungle. Then someone's trying to light it out and I shot it through the back end of the rib cage and then it expired, you know. And this deer I don't know how to describe that deer. Kind of low to the ground, very small. They call it, what do they call it? Basso?
Wasso.
Wasso. Wasso.
It's like the size of a fawn. I feel like a whitetail fawn in Michigan. It does get shot often during hunting season. I mean, one of those deer you can pick up with, you know, one hand. But it just had a little more plumpness to it. So it was the size of a fawn, but it had the
appearance of a mature, of a sexually mature deer.
A fawn during hunting season? I was going to say more like a newborn.
No, not that small.
Way smaller.
Yeah.
Really?
Way smaller. It wasn't like a little, you know how you see those in the fall? You see
it would be if you shot a deer on like, if you shot a deer September 20, a whitetail. Not a November fawn. No way. A small deer, but robust. It had a mature look to it, but small. Reddish colored. Had a tail reminiscent of a whitetail. But proportionately, I felt it had shorter legs.
Yes. Definitely wasn't as leggy as our whitetails.
They drag it up the trail, and I can't remember. There's a term for it. I can't remember what it is. It's where you gut something. I learned the term in Scotland. You gut something from the diaphragm back. So he made just a hole big enough to get his hand in and gutted everything from the diaphragm back, meaning the intestines and the stomach, and discarded them. Didn't hang on to them. Cut a string from tree bark, tied it around its waist and around its shoulders.
Just behind its shoulders?
Yeah. Bloody as all get out, and then throws it on his back and had it out. Nothing more important happened that night.
Nope.
You got to give a visual image of Marco, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's interesting is that, like,
through their night vision of what this guy
is. We are running full long sleeves, pants, and shirts, you know, buffs to protect our necks, and not just for the sun, but because of biting, stinging things, bugs. And these boys, as soon as they get on the trail at night, everybody just takes their shirt off. And, you know, it's just, and Marco has a very Bruce Lee-like look. You know, 41 years old, wiry, cut. And when he put that, it's like it is bark, basically. He takes off of a tree.
It's a strand of bark.
It's a strand. It's maybe like an inch and a half, 2 inches wide. Ties a couple slip knots in it to hold on to the deer. And then it's just the perfect size where it doesn't go across his shoulders, but it comes over his head, and like the strap is right across his chest, just above his nipples.
Yeah, I know they even carry duffel bags like that.
Right.
And the deer is hanging. Like below your clavicles, kind of across your shoulder.
Yeah.
And lean into it.
Yeah. You know? And the deer is hanging basically just above the small of his back. And that was the end of it. We knew at that point that was the end of it. I kind of thought, well, from what I had heard, it was like, oh, you'll kill something, and then the boys are going to keep hunting because you're out there, you're going to keep hunting. But what tipped us off is that the whole way, the next hour, the hike back to camp, it was constant chimani, jibber-jabber.
Yep.
And Steve and I were joking. It's like, you know, we think they're talking about hunting this, that, and the other, but they're probably just catching up on the river gossip.
Yeah. So we get back, and that deer day, they do deer totally, totally different. They quarter the deer and cut the head off at the neck, but leave all the skin on. They cook, and then they got their smoker rack, and they cook the deer with the hair on it. They smoke it with the hair on it. So you just like literally cut the deer up, and you don't pay any attention about hair side down, meat side down, for how many hours?
Too many. More than a lot. Yeah.
They cooked it on that smoker so long that the shanks wound up being like osso buccoed almost in a dry way, where the shank was the delicate part. They're like, here's the best part. He strips that hide off the shank and was pulling little pieces of meat out of there because there's so much gelatin in there that they were still kind of moist and tender. Everything else was just
that reminded me of smoked turkey leg to me. Yep. That venison shanks tasted like smoked turkey, I thought.
And they'll leave it on the smoker, and they'll pull it off the smoker, and it gets swarmed in bees in a way you wouldn't believe.
In general, all of their cutting methods, cooking methods, just a lot rougher than what we're used to. like you said, they don't waste anything. But we also just have learned to take so much more care in the preparation of it all. And I'm not saying
just from a bacteria standpoint.
Yeah, and they're not taking care of it, but like, yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, they cook the hell out of everything, but that wasn't what I was going to say. What I was my feeling on it, in summation, is as unappetizing as what they're cooking might look to an outsider, they relish it more than you relish your food. Totally. I would say.
Yeah.
They're more excited about it than you are about your dinner tonight.
One thing I thought was really cool was that that night, actually both the night of the monkey kill and the deer kill, was to me almost the same exact vibe in an American hunting camp, where they were just absolutely celebrating their hunt. Like, they were just happy as shit. You know, they had some drinks afterward. They were beaming. The entire camp was happy. Everybody huddled around the butchering.
You know, we had those two big-ass catfish, too.
Yeah. No, it was just like, it was a pure celebration.
Everybody was retelling the story of Steve, you know, using the bow and how fast he shot this. You know, Steve's out here with a Hoyt carbon spider, you know, the best of the best, basically, out there as far as modern compound bows.
Showing these guys that bow, you might as well, like someone said, you might as well be like an alien showing them your spaceship. Blown away.
It was almost like the first, like, what you imagine it was like when the Plains Indians or any American Indian saw a rifle.
Yeah, you know, it was really
shot.
Shot at that 6 foot diameter log at 10 yards.
Blown away, man. This whole Bolivia trip, and we've only scratched the surface. We talked about one aspect of it. We're going to turn it into three shows, three episodes, 22 minutes per episode. There's a lot of material, man. And I'll tell you what, coming out of it, I have not a changed perspective, but just a really enhanced perspective where it is fun and very educational and inspiring and beautiful to spend time with indigenous peoples who have a lineage on the landscape that's unbroken. You know, there are many Western influences. We were with these guys had a shotgun, they had flashlights. But all that stuff winds up seeming very superficial to be out with people who are on the land, which is intact. You know, this particular place, I know there's a ton of degradation of rainforest all over the latitudinal lines that have rainforest, and it's a huge environmental concern, a huge conservation concern. But here in this corner of the world, you can have the experience of being out in an intact rainforest, intact jungle, largely untouched, with people who've been knocking around here forever, hunting the things they've always hunted, and in ways the way they've always hunted them. And it really is, despite everything biting you, and the heat and the sweat and just the pervasive uncomfortableness is, as a hunter, very inspiring, very uplifting.
I would say we're coming on, having made about 60 episodes of Meat Eater or more at this point, and I would say whatever you need to do to get your eyes on these shows, because there's something here that's pretty special. Just the depth of the character and of both the place and the people that we were with, that I think it's going to be something to really keep an eye out for.
Yeah, so we air the shows. Not only to turn this into a big ad for the show, but we air the shows on Sportsman Channel. And I'll tell you what, whatever we come up with and whatever we put forward involving this monkey and everything, no one there will mess with it. The cool thing about the network we're at is they don't screw with us at all. We can run things that are shocking and, you know, things you're not going to see anywhere else. Because someone would pull it, but we'll run it. And Thursday's 8 p.m. Or go to MeatEater. Is it TV.VHX or VHX.TV? MeatEater.TV.VHX.
Is it?
Yeah. If you put in MeatEater podcast, you get $5 off any purchase of shows. You can go there and stream them and download them. It's a great way to watch it. The best way to watch it is just to watch it when it comes out. If you can't watch when it comes out, go and download your stream at meateater.bhxcd. Or just go to themeateater.com and you'll find all kinds of stuff in all kinds of ways to watch. But these are going to be special shows, man. You'll get a glimpse of a lifestyle that has been here a long time, but maybe won't be here for much longer. I'm not sure.
And we'll have so much content, I think, here, too, that we'll definitely be throwing up some web specials and putting stuff on the YouTube channel. So it's always good to keep up with the Meateater website because there's always little interesting tidbits that it's a bummer we can't get them into every show, but at least we get to, you know, put them out on the internet somehow so people can check them out.
Yeah, like Marco's jaguar hunting story.
Yeah.
All right. We're hoping that we're going to get picked up by this airplane tomorrow.
If not, we'll be doing another podcast tomorrow.
Doing our podcast.
Let's end it with the Jemani thank you. You should have pie.
You should have pie.
You should have pie.
You should have pie.